haven't been very good about that.
Okay. Good morning. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Education, for Thursday, March 9th, 2017. And I would also like to open the public hearing for Senate Bill 5516 and Senate Bill 5517. And welcome our presenters to the table once again. Thank you all for being here.
Madam Chair, I've asked the agency to come forward for a short discussion before they transition from the special education and associated programs to other education programs to talk a little bit about being able to match Medicaid in certain situations for the use of to offset the need for general fund or to expand services. So that's an issue that folks are interested in and probably will deal with later in the session. But Medicaid in some cases can be used for services around eligible medical and related services, even in the education area. So I've asked them to give a short discussion of it, and we will likely return in phase two to have a deeper discussion with it and have the agency come back.
Great. Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. And we are pleased to be before you again this morning to discuss our budget. We understand that there's been a task force that's working on the topic, working on nursing, and I believe Representative Wisnett is on that task force. Mitch Kruska from our Office of Student Services has been engaged in that process, and Sarah will be able to discuss components of that relative to this particular topic. And we understand that it's a very complicated topic, and we'd be happy to provide additional information or look forward to further discussions with you on it. And I understand that there are a couple of bills that are designed to address some of these aspects in terms of accessing Medicaid funds and facilitating that process with schools and districts. So, Sarah, do we want to start with you?
Yes. Good morning.
I'm sorry, Sarah, if you could excuse me. We had a little potential quorum issue, so I would like to go ahead and reopen Senate Bill 5516 and Senate Bill 5517. Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Monroe, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sarah Drinkwater, Assistant Superintendent with the Office of Student Services, Oregon Department of Education. And I'm happy to be here this morning to give you an overview information about Medicaid and Medicaid billing and the status, the current status of that project or those billings that are going on here already in Oregon. And as Dr. Noor already alluded, the billing process is very detailed and has multiple steps because it involves the federal office called the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services that has a contract with the Oregon Health Authority, which then gives approval to districts, programs, et cetera, to do billing. So it's kind of like a three-tiered or four-tiered process that goes on related to the matching and the billing. So currently, school districts may use Medicaid for services required to provide special education services or those services required to provide free appropriate public education for special education students. Parent permission is required, and parents may withdraw their permission at any time for that Medicaid billing. In addition, school health services for students with special ed also need to be at no cost to the parent. So wanted to make sure that was kind of understood before even billing can occur related to a particular student. So there are two allowable billing types allowed in Oregon through the contract that Oregon Health Authority has with the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. One of those is called Medicaid Administrative Claims, and these relate to outreach activities to students to ensure that they have access to Medicaid services. So they are outreach, communication, helping families and a student access Medicaid services. If a district is doing those types of activities, they typically do a random time study is how the billing is done. There'll be a determined date and a day or a week or so ahead of time. That district will be known that their random study is happening the next day or whatever, and folks engaged in those outreach activities then log their hours. And this this Medicaid Administrative Claims has specific reporting requirements at the end of a year about the outreach activities, et cetera, and it's a 50-50 cost share for that level of billing and that type of billing. The other type allowed under our current contract is called school health services, and these are services under authorized under our current approved state plan, and they are for special education related services or early intervention special education services. And these are reimbursed for direct services to children, and the match rate is determined yearly around October. Currently, the match rate is the district pays 35.5%. But as I mentioned at the beginning, sort of the tier and complication of billing, a district would make a payment through OHA to CMS and then receive funds back. So it's sort of you pay to get money back is an easy way to describe it. In order for this model to be scaled up statewide for approval, for approved special education services, because we know now there are some districts who do bill in early intervention, early childhood special education programs do bill under the school health services, and some do under the Medicaid administrative claim. So if this were to be scaled up sort of statewide, it would need to be researched and evaluated how best to do that. Work in tandem with Oregon Health Authority around that, because it would certainly increase the volume and sort of needs around the whole billing process. In addition, if these funds, and these are federal funds since they're Medicaid dollars, they in and of themselves do not affect maintenance of effort, because you don't count federal dollars into your maintenance of effort. But if you use the federal dollars to replace state dollars, then there would be a maintenance of effort issue at the state level as well as a local level. So it isn't, they certainly could replace, but we would need to see what the impact of that would be on state level maintenance of effort in special education and at district levels. So I, you know, just share that with you because it would take some study and evaluation to determine exactly what the impact would be depending on if those Medicaid funds were used to replace any state dollars that already are associated with maintenance of effort in special education. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, thank you. Representative Parrish.
Thanks. So appreciate this information. We're actually, there's a group of us who are trying to put together a panel for August with the Lund Report. It'll be at the MAC Club. I think we're thinking August 23rd around this topic and bringing in some of the folks from like school nurses, and because I think we're also missing the information about, you know, I've got my own insurance, not on Medicaid. I've got kids, if they're receiving help in the classroom, where does that fall into this mix? When we have conversations about how do we fund things like vision screenings, it's cheaper for us to pay for that, you know, to have the Lions Club come out and do it than have every kid go to the eye doctor and get that done. But we are talking about general fund distribution for that or ed dollars. So trying to get to the bigger conversation about that health care that's being delivered in the classroom and how do we pay for it and how do we properly align it. Are we doing things with private insurance? Are school districts billing private insurance, or are they just tackling the Medicaid side?
They're just currently tackling the Medicaid side. But you talk about, or you mentioned health services that may be provided in a classroom, and the picture that came to my mind was not a special ed student, so a general ed student. And currently, the contract that Oregon State has with, through OHA, with CMS, does not include free services. It only includes the outreach services and the special education services and early intervention, early childhood special ed. So if we were to add that, the contract between CMS and OHA would need to be amended to include that. Currently, Oregon cannot bill for those services.
Madam Co-Chair.
Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for this information. I guess my remarks are going to be addressed to the committee. I think Senator Monroe and myself and Speaker Kotek worked many years ago on our nursing problem in the school districts. Yeah. It's pathetic, to be honest. The national goal is for every 750 students to have one nurse, school nurse. We have one per 4,000 students. Mitch and I worked for a year across over the mountains for a task force on school nurses, and we really wanted to come up with something this time and try to put more nurses in the classroom. Again, the WISNET philosophy of education, they can't learn unless they're not hungry and they're healthy. So Mitch came up with this idea, and it's something that school districts are doing now. This is, as you heard today, that's it's sort of complicated and there's a lot of steps to go through. But some facts are that the school districts are given money to provide X number of services, including school nurses. Some schools prioritize and have a nurse, some don't. So our committee worked hard. We came up with three recommendations, and including some grant money to help low performers who are real bad, but that's not fair to schools that are taking it out of their budget and do it. So I just went with the number one recommendation, which Mitch came up with, which is implementing this system, requiring school districts to do it. We're getting some pushback, and it's hard, it's troublesome, but school districts are doing it. Some school districts defer to their ESDs, and they do the billing. And the bill that both Senator Mona Sanderson and I dropped a bill, she had all three in hers. I had one at the Mitch's recommendation and mine. We decided to run it through the Senate, so I dropped deleted mine not push it, and we amended her bill to have this in it. And I understand it's complicated, but I don't have another solution. In this budget, we're not going to get more money for more school nurses. So I think the bottom line is that we can start the process, and let's get people trained and learn about how difficult this system is and get this money that's out there it was planned to do this, to help school health services, and that includes hiring a school nurse. And Mitch thinks that there's a significant amount of money to be captured to do this, that we could really make a dent in the 1 per 4,000. So I hope the bill makes its way back down to this committee, and we'll have more discussion on this from the Senate, because that's where we're going to plan to move it. But I understand the school district's reluctance, but it's money. It's money, and it's money that we can is going to be dedicated to health services, not for other funds. And so we can reduce this 1 to 4,000 in Oregon. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you for this presentation. So the question I have, do we have some sense today of how many school districts are taking advantage and how much that from a financial standpoint, how much that adds to their ability to provide services?
Co-chairs Smith Warner and Monroe and Representative Lively, I know that Mitch may recall that detail from the report.
Yes, approximately.
I'm sorry, could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I do. Yes. Mitch Kruska, Director of Educational Programs with the Oregon Department of Education. Right now, we understand that approximately 62 districts in the state, either through an ESD, as Representative Wisnett indicated, or directly through OHA bill for Medicaid services that are currently provided. The majority of those districts are very conservative in their billing, and very few of them bill for all services that they could bill for. They really focus on what they consider to be the most impacted high-need kids, and that's what they generally bill for.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. And Senator Monroe?
Yeah, I'm just drink water. I want to make sure I understand this. Maintenance of effort, federal maintenance of effort, requires that we spend at least as many dollars as we spent the previous year.
Co-chairs, correct.
Okay. And so you're saying if we replace some of those state dollars with federal dollars, then we may fall short of maintenance of effort.
That is correct, because maintenance of effort is looking at the state dollars, not at federal dollars.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I heard you right.
Senator Roblin?
Yeah, two quick things. One, it's rare that we have a problem with that at the local level, because we just shift the money to do other things and special needs, so we get a little bit more coverage for those, but I don't know at the state level because I haven't worked at that level. I will say on the getting the Medicare dollars into the schools, where our school district was one of those that did that early, and our ESD helped us train teachers and train nurses and all that stuff, and we've always had that. It's been a boon. It further went down to, we have a adjudicated youth ranch called Bologna Ranch in Coos County, and they looked at that and realized, wow, we have these kids 24 hours a day. We have more of those needs. We have a school classroom on their campus, so the kids are taught until they are shows that they can be successful on campus, and part of the getting out of that program is to have a do a term at the regular high school. So they've done it, and it has really helped them in coming up with the ability to do the work that they're doing and to supplement salaries and wages for all of their people. So I think it behooves Oregon to really look at it and come up with a plan. It was difficult for a lot of people because we have a little survey form that you have to fill out every quarter or whatever, and every teacher does it, and most of the teachers, they don't get anything, but they have to fill out the form, so everybody's doing it. It really is the school nurses that do the most, and those special education classrooms that have multiple kids with difficulties, and there are parts of what they do on a regular basis, which is really healthcare. And so, and it was really through our ESD and the schools in that South County in the ESD that got it, because they were the ones that figured out how to train all of us. So every year there was a little training to let us know, and we'd fill out the form every quarter. And it was certainly helpful for us keeping school nurses in our program. So we don't have as many as we used to, I'll tell you that. And we aren't quite as bad as the state average, but we're probably close.
Okay, so. Thank you.
Can I just do one quick follow-up? I know that when we talk about the number of districts, I always want to know, okay, and what is the percentage of kids that covers? Because 62 districts could be a tiny percentage of kids, or 62 districts could be 80% of the kids in the school. And I know I don't assume you would know that right now, but if you could figure that out, that would be very helpful.
It would actually be a relatively easy number to get.
That's what I figured. Thank you. And Representative Wisnant, before we move on?
Yeah, thank you. Real quick. Some of the feedback I'm getting is that there's a penalty if you do it wrong. Is that true?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Representative Wisnett, there is auditing that occurs from the federal level looking at how the dollars are used. As I mentioned earlier, there are more specific reporting requirements under the Medicaid match, the outreach activities, than there are under this when billing under the special education direct service provided to students, because there's a different way you bill. If you're a speech pathologist giving therapy, there's a different record that you fill out. But the outreach activities have more requirements, and they are audited.
Just a quick thought. So then, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So then, if it's the money's going to a school nurse, that'd be easy to code that every time, right? It's just the other ways that you're using it. Or you have to give each spiff. You have to identify the treatment. Is that what you're saying?
That would be correct. But in outreach, it could be a different staff person who is claiming connection with a hospital or something, and they would need to be able to document that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Hope it comes back.
Okay. Are we ready to move on?
Be happy to come back.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mitch.
Okay, yes. All right. So I will continue where I left off yesterday, and having just spoken about maintenance of effort at the state and local level, I just wanted to remind everyone again which programs related to special education programs are a part of our state maintenance of effort calculation. And you can see the list there. There's probably about 10, Oregon School for the Deaf, early childhood special education programs, all the way down to the second weight, the 11% cap waiver, mm-hmm. and state funds that other agencies may make available for special education students. So just wanted to follow back with that. So I'll move on to child nutrition programs. Grant and aid for child nutrition. Nice picture there, all in color. I think what is important on this slide is that Oregon is the 15th highest state in the nation with food insecurity. Nearly one in six households are food insecure, and we know that nutritional needs of students are critical in building a foundation and making sure students are ready to learn and feel good when they are in school. So ODE administers a child nutrition program, and specifically four of them are listed below: the federal reimbursement program, which is a non-limited program or entitlement program. If more meals are served, then we can look to the federal government for reimbursement. So there is no cap on that. The after-school meal and snack outreach program, breakfast and summer lunch, and then farm to school and the school garden programs. So overall, the CNP budget is mainly funded federally, about 90% of the budget, and it comes from U.S. Department of Agriculture funds.
Co-chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I spent the last 10 years fighting for all those programs and getting them funded. Can you tell us how we compare now with other states in terms of providing for the nutritional needs of our students?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner, I do not know off the top of my head how other states are doing that. We could find information for you about our neighbors in Idaho or Washington, California.
Madam Co-Chair, yeah, I'd like to know that, and if there's anything more, if there's any gaps. You know, we've passed a number of bills over the last few years. I remember a couple of sessions back, I carried like three nutrition bills in a row on the floor of the Senate. So, you know, we're doing as much as we know how to do. I just wondered if there are gaps, if there's something more we need to do, and I'd really like to know how our sister states are doing.
Happy to do that. Not a problem. I will bring up maintenance of effort again related to child nutrition programs. And it's a bit different. Maintenance of effort with the child nutrition programs is about $86,000 that is monitored, and it's specifically related to operations that we have to show the maintenance of effort there for federal child nutrition programs. So it has it, but on a much different scale. So this is the overall look at the current service level budget for 2017-19 at a level of $391 million. And under the child nutrition program, there are the four that I mentioned. You can see in the table that, again, federal funds is the largest at $388 million, and then there are some general funds at $3.8 million. So very much highly federal funds support a lot of the programs. So the first one, federal reimbursement, I mentioned that it's an entitlement or there is no limit. The more meals that we serve, we can request reimbursement for those meals. Under the federal reimbursement program, there are about eight sort of smaller programs, and you can see the list there. A large one, of course, is the National School Lunch Program that many of our districts participate in. Since 2001, the meals we've served here in Oregon has been consistently rising, and in 2016 was over $92 million, and that's nearly an 11% growth over 83 million meals in 2001. So that's very remarkable. Our, as I mentioned, the federal reimbursement are non-limited, and we're looking to maybe being closer to $404 million, and so we would seek to increase the federal limitation in order to be able to reflect the updated projections. The summer and after school meal and snack outreach program, our general funds at $0.5 million. And this, these funds from our state support actually the startup and expansion of programs for after school or summer meal sites. So sometimes there might be a sponsor who wants to expand into this and needs a different capacity freezer or some other piece of equipment. And so these funds would help that sponsor be able to expand into this area so that more meals could be served. We want to make sure they meet the safety requirements, so it's a support for expansion. The breakfast and summer lunch programs are also general funds, $2.1 million. And again, this is ODE providing breakfast and lunch reimbursement, supplementing the federal reimbursement. And you can see there that for the breakfast, 30 cents per meal is provided in addition, and an additional 5 cents per meal for summer lunch. And so far in this biennium, we're looking at an estimated of 5.1 million meals that are supplemented.
Senator Roblin.
So last session, didn't we go to, if you have a free or reduced, if reduced, we paid the other half of the reduced to make sure they were all free? Is that in here?
Yes, that's true, Senator Roblin.
Is that in this budget? I mean, where does that money show up? Because I didn't see in any of those deals extra money going in.
Madam Chair, I can help out with that. It actually was one time, one biennium only. I think the cost was between $2.3, $2.4 million.
Okay, so it's not on the...
And it was a carve-out from the state school fund.
Got it.
And but it was one time.
That's on the additional slide.
That first, yeah. Thank you.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So when you talk about 5 cents per meal or 30 cents per meal, so what's when it's per meal, so what's that is that all students? Is that students across? I'm trying to understand where that gets back, gets distributed.
Well, it first starts with the co-chairs and then Representative Lively. It first starts that students who are eligible under the federal reimbursement program, and so these funds add to the federal reimbursement monies an additional 30 cents and an additional 5
Thank
cents.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm co-chair.
Oh. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, drink water. Is the quality of the meal provided determined by the local school district, or are there some statewide or federal standards for what ought to be provided? I mean, I've heard, for example, criticisms of some breakfast programs where they just give them a half a sweet muffin or something that's not really very nutritious.
Co-Chair Monroe, the federal and child nutrition programs are highly regulated. There are specific meal patterns and specific percentages that of different types of food or ingredients that needs to be included in meals. So there are regulations, and it's highly sort of monitored that the food meal patterns are adhered to by school districts or community programs.
Good.
Senator Robert?
And ketchup is no longer a vegetable.
Yes, I remember that.
In the post-Reagan world, that is
yeah,
correct.
Exactly.
Okay, the last program is the Farm to School and School Gardens, and you'll see on this slide the reference to the one-time carve-out, $3.3 million, that was in the 2015-17 biennium that is being phased out for 17-19. So the Farm to School and School Gardens helps support two types of grants, competitive and non-competitive. The non-competitive grants are available to districts that are already a part of the National School Lunch Program, and it helps to provide reimbursement to those schools for using Oregon-grown or Oregon-processed food. So it's bringing the economy back into Oregon and using what we already have here. The competitive grants are strictly related to educational opportunities, looking at agricultural-based education knowledge, building a school garden or a greenhouse, learning more about cooking, those kinds of educational outreach programs. So that is the Farm to School and its general fund at 1.2 for the 17-19 biennium. So in summary, we've already mentioned a bit about some reductions. There are two reductions in the 2017-19 governor's recommended budget. One in the breakfast and summer lunch program, that is a reduction of $450,000, and a $1.2 million reduction in the Farm to School and School Gardens program. So those reductions total of $1.6 million. And there are no other additional investments requested.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish?
Thanks. So a couple comments, and I think they're more for the general committee. Around some of these dollars that are being spent, because things I've had sort of pet peeve with in the lunch program for a while. Our schools are not exempt from the bottle deposit. So as that goes up to 10 cents a bottle, I came and asked for an amendment in 2007 to the bottle bill that would exempt schools because they're recycling these materials on site, and they are not, they're just paying the nickels to distributors. I was denied that amendment, but it was going to cost the Beaverton school system at that time. When they added bottled water to the mix, they were looking at like double-digit thousands of money dollars going out in nickels that they were never going to recuperate. So I think as the bottle bill goes up to 10 cents, it's time to have that conversation again, because those are money that are coming out of the lunch program, and we're adding more containers to the mix of what types of containers are going to be collected, and that's just money that's going to come right off the plate of kids, and I'm going to keep saying that we need to fix that, because it just comes right off the top. And when you're talking about a program that is really a pennies game, and you can buy a serving of fruit for 10 cents, or you can pay it to the distributors for a bottle deposit, that you know, we don't send lunch ladies back to the Albertsons to recycle and get the nickels back or the dimes back. I think we have to fix that, and I think we need to fix that this session. So that's going to be a sort of a first, just more general comment about costs of doing business. The reality of the cost of doing business in a lunch program. You know, the other thing is we talk about some of the employer mandates that are going to continue to come through. Absolutely affects a program like school lunch. So whether it's minimum wage or sick leave or all of these things that we keep passing, you know, we don't want people to come work sick serving kids, but the reality is that there's no new dollars. The federal government, when we put an employer mandate into the system, the federal government doesn't give us more money, and if the legislature doesn't appropriate additional general funds, this is where school districts drop out of lunch programs. The year that I was first running a school lunch program, we had a school district in the state that was contracting with the local bar to serve school lunch. So I think it's really important that we make sure that when we put costs into the system, if we're not offsetting those costs with additional dollars, that's where you get, Senator Monroe, sort of the less quality, you know, cheaper goods,
yeah.
Things that aren't hot, things that aren't high in protein, because those things cost money. Or, you know, so if you didn't know, I used to be former queen of the lunch ladies in my school district. But so this is a near and dear to my heart to me, and I think that there's some challenges that we're putting into the system in the lunch program that that don't need to be there, and we should fix them this session.
Thank you. And I just want to comment, though, that milk continues to be excluded from the bottle bill.
It does, but there's other that's things all. That
right.
we serve, and we serve things that
but
don't.
But just to be clear, yeah.
Absolutely.
Because that's, I mean, the first thing I think of when I think of school lunches is milk. And they are still, that is still exempt.
And I will say, and I have to do this for my wife, who was an elementary principal who fought with our food service all the time to get nutritious meals for her kids, because it was in one of those poorer school districts, and she wanted to have salad bars, and she wanted to have not sugar cereals and a bunch of those other things. And you can do it, but you have to be attentive to it, and you have to fight all the time with your whatever, because, again, it goes back to those pennies, and everybody's trying to make it pay for itself. And she fought hard, and it worked really well, and then she retired, and it's not going quite as well right now. So it does take somebody who wants to be the queen of the lunch program in her place, or the individual principals or others, if you really want to get the best quality of food for everyone, because they will meet the requirements the federal government lays, but
yes.
They could be better.
Senator Monroe?
Yeah, I know there was a time there when they were requiring 1% milk, for example. Well, 1% milk may be good for adults, but children need a little bit of fat in their diet. And, you know, 2% milk is better for their actually the growing body, their nutritional needs. I like the farm program. I want to make sure that kids are able to get Thompson's Good Pears, for example, or
Tillamook. Pears in every school.
Yeah, pears in every school, or Tillamook dairy products on the coast, or, you know, this state produces a lot of good stuff, and we want to make sure it's available to our students.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator.
Along that line, we did have our Santiam green beans, all the kind of stuff that are packaged here, went everywhere else in the world and weren't being bought here. So it was a little frustrating, so I do appreciate that.
Rep Wisnett, before we move on to CTE, because I know we all want to.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I think the comments made were very good, and I endorse Representative Parrish's comments. Mr. Wilson, is this in the co-chairs? Are we have to face this in the co-chairs? Is this being cut, this much money?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, the co-chairs budget works off the current service level amount, so these two cuts are not part of their calculations.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay.
But there are two things that you've mentioned that were in the 15-17 budget right. Do not carry forward. The roughly $3 million from farm to school, that was the add-on,
right.
And then the $2.4 million reduced to free lunch thing,
yes.
And that is not in CSL.
And we will have that discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Transition.
Thank you, Don. Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, with your permission, I would like to invite Don Huckabee, our Assistant Superintendent for Teaching, Learning, and Assessment, to join me at the table. Our next presentation will focus on grant and aid programs in areas such as CTE, career technical education, science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM-related programs. Educator effectiveness and closing the achievement gap, if we have an opportunity to get to that today. And these programs are both federally and state supported as well. So,
okay. Good morning. Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. My name is Don Huckabee. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Teaching, Learning, and Assessment with the Oregon Department of Education. And thank you for the opportunity to share about the programs that are operated within the offices, the teams within my office. some examples of our students who are involved in our career technical ed and STEM programs across the state. We just wanted to give you a sense of the grants within this particular section around CTE and STEM are included, really represent opportunities for our students and our educators in the area of career and technical education, or CTE will be perhaps how I might address it, as well as science, technology, engineering, and mathematics STEM. They are investments to help prepare our students to be have the skills that are necessary to be in a global economy. Each of the grants and programs that you see listed here will be addressed in more detail in the slides that follow. This slide represents the current service level for the programs that and grants that are identified. And you can see that they are primarily split. There are about half the programs are state funded, and about half of the resource here is federal. One thing I do want to note on this slide, and I'll mention again when we get to the Carl Perkins Federal, one of the requests yesterday was to identify where we might have requirements around matching. With the Carl Perkins grant, we don't have a match dollar for dollar. However, we are required to set aside non-federal funding up to 5% of the grant that we receive, or $250,000, whichever is greater. And that amount is shared not only with the Department of Education, but with also CCWD, as they receive a portion of these Carl Perkins funds as well. CCWD is Community Colleges Workforce Development is part of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Thank you. The first grant to discuss here is the STEM Regional Network Grant, and it was established in 2013 as part of testimony provided by staff from the Chief Education Office. I believe you received information about the structure and the work of the STEM hubs. Staff in our office administer these grant programs and work very closely with the Chief Education Office in the programming and the support. Six STEM hubs were funded in the 13-15 biennium. In this biennium, five additional STEM hubs were funded, and also then the original six received resources to continue expanding the program. What you see here are the 11 STEM hubs, and what you may make note of is that there are four counties in gray that do not have currently have STEM hubs engaged in there. However, I do want to reassure you that students and educators in these counties have access to the STEM innovation grants that are described on a later slide, and also that they are encouraged and invited to be part of any STEM activities and convenings across the state. And it's my understanding that the five that were funded in this biennium, that's exactly what they did. They participated in the STEM activities of the original six so that they could learn more about how this community action and orientation and connections were happening. And so we're encouraged that these other counties are also pursuing that and thinking about how they might localize their work around STEM investments. The next grant is the Career Technical Ed Revitalization Grants. These were established to provide, and these are competitive. Provide an opportunity for business, industry, and labor to partner with our school districts around high-demand, high-wage areas, and they teach a high level of academic and technical skills. One key component of this is student leadership, and as well as a connection to a STEM-based or legislative priorities as we look at awarding these grants. Innovation is encouraged, and we also, these grants allow for an outreach back to middle schools for a seamless connection from middle school to a high school program, which then that high school program also needs to connect then to a community college. And so you'll see here that 25 grants were awarded during this biennium, and that supports 142 schools across the state.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. On that piece about connecting the grants to programs at the high school level to community college, what does that actually look like, sort of boots on the ground? Is that just that kids understand and are aware that the program they're studying is in the local community college? Are the kids getting college credit to do those programs? Because it seems to me if we're going to make larger and continue to try to make larger investment in STEM, and most schools can't stand up a STEM program for $800 a student, that we are really trying to partner in with the community college to to help do that, because they have these types of programs, but that those kids are also getting sort of a dual benefit of that community college credit for the work.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Parrish. It looks, every one of these programs has to have a program of study. So they have to have an articulation with a community college. It may or may not be one locally to them. Obviously, some community colleges are farther away from some of our schools than others. But there has to be that connection. And so some students do receive those dual credits. Some of them do receive opportunities to be on campus. In some of our other grants, there are more of those opportunities for them to be engaged at the college level. The Career Pathway Fund supports existing qualified career and technical education programs of study and incentivizes our programs that are serving students who have been historically underrepresented in that area of study. These resources are utilized in specific courses and classrooms versus being available for any CTE course. So the specific courses that have demonstrated that they have this program study and they are encouraging and supporting and serving more students who have been underrepresented have weights to the resource, and so they get more resource than other programs of study within there. It is allocated on students enrolled in a qualified CTE program, and in these they must be expended where the qualifying student where the funds were allocated. You can see here that 57% of all of our CTE programs of study received a career pathway grant during the 2016-17 year, and these grants ranged anywhere from $2,000 to $45,000 per classroom per year. The STEM innovation grants are grants that are awarded to our schools to expand their access and implementation of effective programs in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. These are competitive to encourage schools to explore approaches that will transform instruction within the STEM disciplines. These grants have a strong component of professional development for the educators, as well as engagement of students in both school opportunities as well as out-of-school learning. And so you'll find in this particular grants there are a number of opportunities where our students are engaged outside of the school setting, and that we recognize that learning doesn't just occur within the four walls of the school and or the confines of the school day from 8 to 4. And so you see that we have four programs that were awarded. The Adaptive Math Pilot is engaging 33 schools, about 4,000 students, and 150 teachers are involved in that. The Computer Science and Digital Literacy, 400 teachers, 22,000 students, and 57 schools. Math in Real Life is 122 teachers, 12,000 students, and those are primarily middle school and high school teachers and students who are engaged in that. And then the out-of-school STEM is in 43 locations with 1,000 students. And of those students, 70% of them represent underserved or underrepresented students.
Senator Roblin?
So the out-of-school robotics classes, the robotics things, would that be part of that group?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Senator Roblin, potentially, although we do have a separate fund that is supporting the robotics.
Okay. And the other thing I think that some people get confused with, STEM and CTE are very different programs in that STEM can be an individual course or whatever. CTE has to be a program. And I think we confuse them sometimes when we talk about it in the building amongst people.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Representative Parrish?
Thanks. What does the department do around these programs, both on the CTE and the STEM, to help districts translate maybe some of the coursework that kids are taking into applicability for things that we've said are graduation requirements? So I've got a bill in another committee that's waiting for a hearing that would essentially say that coding could meet the world language requirement. Other states are doing that. It certainly is its own language for that, yeah. That's for sure. But other states have treated that as a math class, and other states have treated it as a science class. So how are we helping on that front? Because I feel like sometimes there's a little bit of pushback of, like, how do you fit a STEM program or a CTE program and put it in a bucket so it's not necessarily eating up every kid's elective, but that it's actually counting and that we're tailoring sort of the curriculum to meet a math requirement or a science requirement or a language requirement and help kids get those credits and not potentially fall behind or need extra time because they want to do the CTE or STEM route, but it screws them up in biology.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Parrish. Actually, one of these other grants specifically is doing that work, is having our partnerships around looking at what are the content standards that are embedded in career technical ed within the STEM to identify what other content standards may be being addressed and to be able to award credit in those ways. So we are doing that work, looking at how do we do a better job of that. We need to do more professional learning with our schools and districts and our teachers to help them better understand how they can leverage the opportunities that are available within our current system.
Madam Co-Chair, if I may just add to what Don just shared with you, we have a diploma in the state of Oregon that was updated in 2007, and it's a proficiency-based diploma. It allows districts to grant credit based on proficiency, and that proficiency is based on demonstration of knowledge and skills relative to the content standards in a subject area in any setting. So a student can actually demonstrate proficiency in math and science and social studies through a variety of projects in school and out of school. They can demonstrate proficiency relative to the math content standards in a manufacturing or a construction class. So the diploma currently allows for that. The rules are written to allow for that. And I will just share with you that we are preparing a memo to go out to the field to remind them that we do have a proficiency-based diploma, that there is a tremendous amount of flexibility that they can exercise to award full credit or partial credit. So it could be a combination of courses that students are engaged in construction and manufacturing, where they earn half a credit of math and a half credit of science, if you will, and that can be translated into a full math class or science class that the student is also associated with. So we believe that there is a lot of flexibility. We just want to remind our colleagues in the field and our districts that you have a lot of flexibility as long as you're meeting the content standards for that subject area. That's what's important. And as long as you're also meeting the licensure and certification requirements, because you could have what's called a teacher of record, where a math teacher is working with a construction teacher, and together they're agreeing on the credits that will be issued in a construction class in association with a math class or a math requirement that the student is engaged in.
Thank you. Go ahead.
The CTE summer program grants are resources that provide direct service to students in both high school and middle school and occur through summer programs. High school students are able to build skills through connections to the state of art equipment and facilities that may not be readily available in their local schools. And the middle school students are provided opportunities to engage in and explore what career technical education programs are available at their local high school. So to give you a sense of what some of the activities students were engaged in last summer, there were internships with local business, robotics, health sciences, trades training, advanced technology skills, digital design, aerospace technology, expanded CTE programs, again, with that state-of-the-art equipment, automotive tech, fire science. Our students were actively engaged in a wide variety of career technical ed. And you can see we awarded 10 grants to recipients, and currently they served approximately 2,200 students across the state. And we will be continuing that program then here this summer. Just to give you a sense of the location where those programs occurred, they were in the Hillsborough, Salem-Keizer, Treasure Valley Community College areas, Douglas County, Intermountain ESD region, Portland Community College had one of the grants, the Center for Advanced Learning. There was a program in East Portland, Lane ESD, and then Portland Public Schools. So just to give you a sense across the state where those grants and the students that were participating were from. Under the Career and Technical Ed, we had also a statewide teacher development and mentoring program that provided an opportunity to increase the need and support the increased need for our career technical educators. This provided local and regional training opportunities for both new and existing career and technical education teachers. It provided mentoring for CTE teachers who were new to the classroom, and it supported teachers who are especially coming from industry to gain full certification and licensure with TSPC. We've been working with the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to develop new rules, and those new rules that are being brought forward provide even more flexibility for schools or our ESD CTE consortia, because some of our CTE work through ESDs, and applicants in obtaining and maintaining their career technical education license. It's been streamlined so that it will have a better creation for digital applications and really will help provide opportunities for especially our industry partners who come into the classroom to gain the certification and licensure that's required. To kind of highlight some of the summer the programs, Eastern Oregon CTE Mentoring Project provided mentoring for every beginning CTE teacher in Baker, Union, Wallala, Grant, Harney, and Malheur counties. There were 14 beginning teachers in 12 school districts. They meet with three retired CTE mentor teachers. These mentors are spending countless hours and thousands of miles traveling to spend valuable time with teachers in the classroom, on the phone, and using FaceTime and other technology to help those beginning teachers adapt to that new classroom environment and improve their instruction. The CTE Student Leadership Organization grants were provided to support students with additional opportunities to develop their leadership, their academic, and their career skills, as well as to provide an opportunity for them to extend their learning beyond the classroom into their community and beyond. These grants have provided increased opportunities for them to become involved in their chartered career technical student organizations and also to assist those career technical student organizations in developing their own financial independence through further development and requirement that they build strong industry relationships and tap into other resources. Skills that our students are getting through these particular grants are technical writing skills, technical content, as well as skills, obviously, in communication, in networking. There are opportunities to network across not only with their peers, but also with industry partners, teamwork, problem solving, career development, and personal management. As Senator Roebling asked about the robotics program, the actual title is First Inspiration and Recognition of Science Technology, or you'll often hear it called FIRST Robotics. And this particular program is an international program, and as you see there, the stated mission the mission is to inspire young people to be science and technology leaders and by engaging them in those mentor-based programs at an early age that inspire their innovation and their well-rounded life capacities to be more self-confident, have better communication and leadership. The purpose is to increase the number of students who are interested in science, technology, engineering, and management. I was a former business teacher, so management's what comes forward to me instead of mathematics in STEM-related careers, and to elevate really that community partnership because these grants require a community element to them. First grants were awarded to schools in 21 of our 36 counties and reached approximately 2,000 students. Some of the quotes, we are getting some anecdotal information from students that it is encouraging them to think about STEM careers that they might not have otherwise. And we've seen an increase in robotic programs in our rural areas in particular. The course equivalency grants were identified, and this was to get to Representative Parrish's question about that connection of core content to career technical ed. These particular grants provided support to our high schools in that development of looking at CTE courses and how they might satisfy other high school credits in core content areas, and that would also then meet those admission requirements for community colleges and public universities through either adopting a full or partial set of course equivalencies in career and technical ed, and developing procedures for making sure that that approval is happening. Some examples of courses that were accomplished in the pilot project in Bend High School, they partnered woodworking with an applied technical math course. They in Dayton High School, agricultural technology and science, and at Willamette High School, motion graphics with language arts. In most cases, a full CTE credit is being provided. And in most cases, it's usually a half a credit in the core academic content areas.
And could you just run through what those five high schools were? Clearly Bend and another one that you...
I'm going to have to get you the other two.
Okay.
So I will get those to
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. The last program or grant in this section is the federal grant, the Carl D. Perkins federal grant. It is designed to develop those full and robust career, academic career, and technical skills through for secondary and post-secondary students. And this is a grant that comes to the state that is for our high schools as well as community college. Funds are used at the state level for leadership activities, and we then give grants back out to schools and districts. Either a school will receive their resource directly, or if they are a small number or a small high school, they will get their resource through a consortium. Typically, those consortiums are operated out of our ESDs. The federal funding is a formula. 85% of that does go out to the schools, then districts, and 10% is retained for state activities, and then 5% is remaining for the administration. The professional part
Senator,
of what we...
Senator Roblin?
Yes. So you had mentioned earlier that we have a match that we have to do for this, but it's not showing here. So does it come from other programs we're doing?
So, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Munro, Senator Roblin, we take that out of our administrative on the operations side. So as we look at our match of that, and again, we split that with CCWD, so it's okay. Part of what we show in our career technical at intersecondary.
So it's an in-kind basic contribution as opposed to direct money?
No, there's... Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Roblin, there is an actual general fund appropriation that is a match.
Okay.
And I think it's either, you said $250,000
or 5% of the grant.
Mm-hmm. And whichever is
greater.
Mm-hmm. So there is an actual appropriation that you will see in our operations budget that's a match specifically for Perkins.
Okay.
To give you a sense of a little bit of what that 10% we use for the state resources, we provide professional development to the teachers, administrators, and counselors that are connected to the programs of study, and really aims at making sure that they understand what those effective practices are to build strong student support systems. Also, monthly convenings of our stakeholders to stay on top of the trans activities and needs and processes, and that includes our career technical ed regional coordinators, the community college CTE deans, and the CTE dual credit coordinators are attended to those meetings. I wanted to give you a little bit of information about where we think this legislation is. Currently, last week, the House Subcommittee on Early Childhood, Elementary, and Secondary Education held a hearing on secondary CTE. Reauthorization appears to be a high priority for the committee. You may be aware that at the federal level, in the last session, this committee did pass a reauthorization bill with a 405-5 vote, but it progress stalled with the looming election in the Senate. So we're anticipating that will move forward here in this next session at the federal level, and we'll keep you apprised of what happens with that.
Great. And so the next slide, I believe, is the overall budget
Correct.
Recommendations.
Correct.
Can I ask, let me ask a question before we get to that, because it kind of has to do with that. So this is all great information. It's very helpful to have this kind of laid out of here are all the CTE and the STEM things that we're doing. And on behalf of Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici, I think I have to call out that one of the things they did in that committee in the House was add the A for Arts to the STEM in that federal bill.
Yes.
So that's me channeling her. But the thing that strikes me as we look at this is two issues. Number one, I hear a lot. So I'm from Northeast Portland, and we meet with the Multnomah area superintendents. And what I hear over and over again is, please fewer competitive grants, because it disadvantages smaller districts that don't have somebody who can write grants full time. And so the first thing that jumps out at me is all of these beyond the region, well, again, even the STEM regional network grants, that they almost all seem to be competitive grants. And that is a concern when we are talking about this as particularly as a way for, I mean, it's for all kids and the rural areas and the smaller districts and the poor districts. So that is kind of a big picture concern or question that I have about all of these seeming to be competitive grants. Number two is my concern about, are each of these administered by different people or different, you know, how much siloing is there versus how much coordination is there in all of these grants? I mean, if, you know, is there indeed, because one of the things I wrote down is, could we have one big map with all of the grants that we just did in this section portrayed visually so that we can see who is getting it where and where there is overlap, mm-hmm. and where there is not. And that just led me to, is there, you know, is there duplication in how these are all being administered, or are they being looked at collectively? Because indeed, we're facing conversations in this legislature about how to implement Measure 98, which CTE and STEM is a part of. And so to me, this is one of the things that's most important is what are we doing already? What are the avenues through which we are doing this stuff? How can that potentially fit in or not? And my prime and the biggest read I get from this is, wow, we have all these things, and I'm worried that they're in a bunch of little silos, not to mention the fact that the STEM grants, the regional hubs, has no relation to the early learning hub division, but that's an ongoing thing about for every organization there is a different allocation of regional. I was just having this conversation with somebody yesterday, so I'll stop and let you respond.
Representative Smith-Warner, as we will definitely get you a map that shows where these investments have been made. We work very closely with our team, the secondary post-secondary transitions team within our office, works very tightly together. And so staff within that team, when these grants go forward, they're looking at the requirements of the grant. These grants many times had reviewers that were outside of our department, outside of the agency, included industry, business, the chief education office, technology. So looking at them in a holistic manner, although the grants did go out in separate applications. So we may not, I mean, there were probably more opportunities we could have looked a little more cohesive and comprehensive.
Because, I mean, even that makes me think, you know, what about the idea of here are the nine grants we have for STEM and CTE. I, as a school or a district, right, here's what I'm looking at doing. Which one of these does this make the most sense for so that we can allocate the most? And again, not disadvantaging those schools that don't have that grant writer. I'm going to
Madam Chair, if I may
get Dr. Noir speak, and then I will recognize you.
Defer to the Senate.
Do you want to answer first?
Yeah, do you want to answer first?
If I may just add to Co-Chair Smith-Warner's questions, we agree that the competitiveness tends to discriminate, if you will, against certain regions because the capacity varies dramatically from one region to another. We have tried through the application process to connect the dots. So when we think about underserved students, we make sure that those are part of every application. On the CTE revitalization grants, we made sure that STEM was also addressed. And when we think about the STEM hubs, we look at the work that they're doing in CTE. The positive here is that our CTE folks that manage these programs are working collectively and collaboratively on trying to make sure that everything is threaded through and that there are connections and we're not duplicating and we're not causing havoc to the field, recognizing that they have to apply for many of these grants. The other thing that I would suggest is that we ensure that there is geographical distribution to the extent possible. I used to co-chair the CTE revitalization grants, and that is something that we looked at very carefully, to look at all of the applications that came in, and we always put the map up to make sure that quality grants were funded first and foremost, but we also paid attention to geography and making sure that we provided access to as many regions and as many places as we possibly can. However, it's still a competitive process, and it still has barriers to some districts from being able to access those resources. So
I guess I would, you know, is there a way to, after you do that, look and see, okay, who's not even applying? Who is not even applying?
Yes.
And what are the needs that we're missing there? Senator Roblin, and then I'll...
So two things. One, the first one, Boley is also working on some of the same stuff. Are they coordinating with you with respect to how that goes about happening?
Mm-hmm. Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Roblin, yes, there is coordination between us and Boley relative to some of these grants that we jointly, not necessarily administer, but at least get together to define the criteria and award, and then there's collaboration. In fact, one of our staff members spent a couple of days a week at Boley in the interest and the desire to maintain connections and to increase collaborations between the two agencies.
Okay. But my other follow-up? Question... My other question has to do with, are we having conversations with TSBC and higher ed about actually having teachers trained in our state with respect to CTE and these other programs? Mm-hmm. Because when we used to do that more, those people came with an educational understanding of what CTE was, with an educational understanding about how you go getting Carl Perkins. Now most of us in schools are going to industry and finding someone.
Yes.
With your help, we're going through the process. They're getting a certification, but they haven't got a clue about, I mean, you have to have somebody in your building that knows you're going to go form a team, you're going to get these people from the community, you're going to kind of look at your whole program set up. It's a big learning curve, and if we don't have some of those people that have come through an educational institution, so we're looking at Idaho and Montana as opposed to Oregon, are those conversations happening? Since CTE is becoming a much bigger conversation, are we having conversations with them?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Senator Roblin, we are having those conversations with TSPC about what does that higher ed and prep look like. I believe there are still some barriers around some funding at the higher ed level of what those programs, and are they going to generate enough students for the positions, although we do know that with career and technical ed, we're seeing a lot of retirements here of longtime staff who have been career technical ed teachers and needing to replace them. So there is a demand. It's working with TSPC and the higher ed to build that up. Yeah. So, yes, okay. We are working with them.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Parrish, please.
As people are coming to you, school districts are coming to you for these grant dollars or programs coming for grant dollars, is there any criteria at all that the programs that people are coming forward and saying, hey, we want to do this, are we tying that at all to needs of the actual workforce so that we are making sure that there's an article in the Wall Street Journal the other day that the U.S. Department of Labor says we need 1 million coders in the next 3 years? Not like in 10 years, we need them in 3 years, and we're not putting people into that pipeline. So as we're thinking about these types of grants, are we looking at that type of data around workforce need to know that in our state, where aviation's, you know, is a cluster hub for us for economy, but we can't get pilots and we can't get mechanics, those are, you know, sort of those silver collar jobs in terms of how much they pay, are we focusing on tying these CTE grants to real world workforce needs?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Monroe, Representative Parrish, yes. Most of those grants require a partnership within their local communities, and so with those local communities identifying what are those high-wage, high-demand, and opportunities for their students. So those are requirements that are built into the grants.
If I may add, Madam Co-Chair, many of the programs that are submitted for approval as a program of study must demonstrate to us that they've utilized labor market information both locally and regionally, and we even ask them to submit national trends relative to emerging occupations and high-demand, high-wage occupations. So there's a lot of structure to that process. Some of the other programs are really designed to introduce students to career pathways and career options and don't require the same level of rigor, if you will. And what I really want to emphasize about a lot of these opportunities is the access that we're providing to teachers in particular to expand their knowledge and skills and experience relative to CTE and STEM, because they're really the vehicle to building those programs and making them available to students. But we do have a structured process relative to programs of study in particular that really require 2 years in high school and 2 years at the community college, leading to a certificate, could be an industry certificate or a college certificate, but it's a skill-based certificate. So thank you.
Senator Roblin, before
and,
we move
and
on
the
to the
community
last
colleges
slide.
Have developed kind of a range of things that they do, and some, a lot of them don't. So we have a radio program at the high school. There's no radio program at our community college, so it may be up in the Portland area that you have the connection, but Department of Ed and everybody helps align those programs together, which I think is a really positive part of what's happening, and let them know where they exist.
Thank you.
So to wrap up, this is the governor's recommended budget, and as you'll see here, there are some reductions that are being recommended in the governor's budget, approximately $15.1 million, all of which come from the general fund. Three programs are eliminated in the governor's budget, as you'll see here, the Career Pathway Fund, the CT Summer Programs, and the Statewide Teacher Development and Mentoring Program, as well as then, I guess, the first and course equivalent grants are also, so actually there are five.
Okay.
So, question is, do you want to move forward?
Let's keep going. Yeah,
okay, great.
Let's see how much we can do.
All right. The next section of this presentation is around educator effectiveness grants that support our educators, and really to be more effective in their practices. These are critical to educator effectiveness, is obviously critical to student success, and there's a growing body of research that indicates that student achievement is definitely influenced by teacher quality, and that our teachers are well-versed in the culture and understanding of their students. And so these grants, you'll see, both reflect a general fund as well as federal funds, and you'll notice that some of these funds are part of the state school fund carve-out, so we'll call those out for you as well. The current service level for these, you'll see that primarily the bulk of these resources come from federal resources, although there are grant funds, but most the next big one really is around the other funds, and that again is the carve out for the network for quality of teaching and learning. First one we want to share about is the School District Collaboration Grant. And this particular grant was established in 2011, and it provides funding to school districts to improve student achievement through voluntary collaboration with their teachers and administration to implement new approaches that lead to career pathways for teachers and administrators, new approaches in the evaluation process for both of those groups of educators, changing potential compensation models, and then enhanced professional development opportunities for the teachers. This funding is a combination of the general fund and the state school fund. Again, that is that carve out for the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning. What we're seeing initial data from the districts that have been involved with from the beginning shows that the longer the district is engaged in these conversations and the work of the grant, the better the student academic and graduation results when compared to districts that are newer in the program. Additionally, we from the TEL survey, which is given every 2 years, an opportunity for teachers and building principals to share their perception data of working conditions, shows that teachers and principals in these districts that have been part of the collaboration grants have higher rates of satisfaction in the areas of professional learning, observation, and feedback around evaluation, and that informs their practice and provides overall support to their work.
And are these many of the grants that the Chalkboard Project
yes.
is doing?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, in collaboration.
I'm sure we have all heard about.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
The mentoring grants provide a program to our beginning teachers and our beginning administrators with through a formally assigned mentor. These resources support 1 or 2 years of mentoring. And this grant is also part of the State School Fund as a carve-out for the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning. It's my understanding that you received additional information about the mentoring at a request from the first few days of testimony back in February in a memo that was dated February 22nd. So I won't cover a whole lot more than what you see here unless there are other questions. Leadership training grants, they're twofold. One with the leadership is an opportunity for current sitting district and building level administrators to engage in professional learning that increases their effectiveness. The new piece that we have that has become fully implemented this year is an opportunity for aspiring leaders to be part of a aspiring leadership cohort to be partially released from their existing duties. Primarily, these are classroom teachers who are released from their teaching duties for half a day, and then they take on administrative duties with their existing building principal to have a more job-embedded learning opportunity as they are working towards their administrative credential. And so we have 32 teachers in that part of the program representing 25 districts who are in that partial release in their initial administrative licensure program. And they are partnering with two entities, higher education providers, and basically to strengthen this pipeline. One of the things I want to draw your attention to that one of the primary goals was to identify and make sure that we have a representative of underrepresented teachers of color to become administrators of color. And so this particular cohort, over half, well over half, are teachers of color who are aspiring leaders. And so it's significantly different than other cohorts that we've seen. And our hope is through that is that anecdotally they're indicating that they're having those hard conversations around equity and what does culturally responsive teaching look like and what how would they support that as building administrators. The Effective Teacher Preparation Grants, or another, we often call it Teach Oregon, is an opportunity where we have schools and districts that are engaged with community colleges and universities to improve the teacher preparation. And this practice is really breaking down those organizational silos and encouraging unified practices and priorities. The honest conversations are being had on the lack of our culturally diverse teachers currently employed, and these new programs are intended to recruit and retain a more diverse workforce. The focus has been on clinical practice, that student teaching and mentoring of beginning teachers with a well-rounded classroom experience where they feel supported during their teacher training as well as during the first years of their teaching career. We have over 500 cooperating teachers trained in co-teaching strategies. We have 113 middle school students in pro-team programs, 71% of them are culturally diverse, and it's designed to encourage those talented middle school students to consider teaching as a profession. We have 212 high school students, 62% of them are culturally diverse, are enrolled as teacher cadets and aspiring teachers. We have 212 community colleges students in teacher pathway programs, 75% of them are culturally diverse. Over 80 scholarships have been awarded since 2014. Almost 1,100 beginning teachers are receiving mentoring services through district and regional programs, and 200 or more educators are trained in equity and equitable hiring practices. Assessment literacy grants. This is a support to our classroom teachers to provide professional learning on royalty-free, editable and shareable resources that any Oregon educator may use. We have three primary programs that have been funded through this. One is a performance assessment demonstration site, and these teams are developing, administering, and collaboratively scoring extended curriculum-embedded performance assessments. We have the Oregon Formative Assessment Student Support Team. These teams are engaged in a year-long course of study and applying aspects of formative assessment in their own classrooms. And then we had Building Educator Assessment Literacy, and those are all of these are ongoing right now. We had one that had to be canceled in Eastern Oregon yesterday due to weather, unfortunately. But our educators there are collaboratively scoring student work, and then they plan further performance assessments. So while we've got a small number of teachers involved right now, these resources then will become available statewide, and so we're building some capacity around our assessment literacy through these grants. And the last one in this section is our Title IIA Federal Teacher Quality Grant, and it is a federal program resource that comes to us from the federal government. It's distributed comes to the state, and then we distribute it out to the local education agencies through a federal formula. And one of the things I want to draw your attention to from my federal level, there, with the change in Every Student Succeeds Act, there are some changes in how this will be funded. And one of them is due to a change in how they are going to calculate what they call hold harmless. And so we are going to see a reduction of about 14.3% over the next 3 years as a result of that in these funds that will come to the state of Oregon. And these are primarily for supporting teachers and administrators. Every Student Succeeds Act allows a broader interpretation of the use of these funds, so we're very excited, and our educators are very excited about the opportunities that will be afforded to them to be able to use these funds in ways that they historically, under No Child Left Behind and with our waiver, they were primarily focused for teachers in mathematics, English language arts, and science. So this expands for basically all teachers in all content areas. The other change I want to that may offset some of that 14.3% reduction is there is going to be a change in the allocation based on poverty. Currently, the formula is 35% of the distribution is based on population with 65% based on poverty. That is going to shift to be 20% based on population and 80% based on poverty. So we're anticipating that we will see some increase in the funding due to that, but we won't see that until the 18-19 school year. That will be when that will start. In the governor's recommended budget, there are some reductions of approximately $1 million. The mentoring grant is the one that does not see a reduction.
Okay. I would just briefly give a little bit of a similar comment about this, about the idea of maybe looking at these in concert and having conversations about how siloed all the decisions are or not about where these go, because it all seems to be very interactive. Not quite as much. And also, I would be interested going forward in more information about the federal one, the Title IIA, because that seems the squishiest. Yes. I mean, the rest of them seem very specifically targeted,
right.
And that seems, and maybe it's just that it goes out to districts and that's more the day-to-day CLE, the teacher version of continuing education.
To see it all on a map.
Right.
All of
them. Yes, that would be helpful. And are there any other questions? I'm sorry to have hogged the mic there. Okay, with that, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5516 and Senate Bill 5517. We will continue those next week. We do have public testimony days set for next week,
on
Mr.
Wednesday
Wilson.
Wednesday and Thursday, one day, I think it's the first day, is on early learning. And the youth development, the second one is K-12.
Great. Okay, and with that,
thank
we
you.
Are adjourned. Okay, and with that,
thank
we
you.
Are adjourned.